Well, hey, everybody, it's Kevin Stevenson. Thanks for joining me today on I Don't Care with Kevin Stevenson. Always pleased that you choose to spend a little bit of your time with me on these little podcasts. So today's guest, you know, you figured I got to have another Baylor Bear on. Yeah. So this is my good friend and Baylor fraternity brother for a little while, Dr. Roy Smythe. Roy, welcome to I Don't Care.
Hey, Kevin, thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
Man, it's great to see you. We got a chance to see each other when I went up to Boulder for the Baylor-Colorado game. We didn't quite have the ending of that game that we wanted, but boy, the years turned out pretty well, huh?
That's right. Well, actually, for both those teams, turned out probably better than initially thought. So, yeah, it's been a good season.
Yeah, it has. I'm looking forward to going to the Texas Bowl here at the end of the year. So that's going to be a really good time. I wish, you know, you just go ahead and start. You've had a really interesting career. Surgeon, businessman, venture capitalist, innovator. Tell my audience a little bit about kind of your journey.
Sure. Happy to do that. You know, when someone says, you've had a really interesting career, that can mean many things.
True.
For me, it tends to be, I keep trying to find something that I'm really good at. So, you know, grew up in a small town in Texas, went to Baylor undergrad, was a football player on Grand Taft's 1980 championship team in the South. And then went on to medical school. And after graduating from medical school at A&M, I spent 10 short years at the University of Pennsylvania, training in general surgery, surgical oncology, and cardiothoracic surgery. A quick side note, sort of between medical school and residency, I did a fellowship at Wharton, a healthcare policy fellowship called the Dana Scholars Program, which figured really importantly in my decision to transition my career out of clinical care, you know, later on, and we can come back to that. But after medical school residency, as I mentioned, and then had a succession of academic surgical jobs, I spent 8 years at MD Anderson on staff there as a thoracic surgeon. And then from there, went to Baylor Scott & White. At that time, it was just Scott & White as the chairman of the Texas A&M Medical School Surgery Department and for the health system, the surgery chair for the health system. You could describe it one or two ways. You could either say it was a midlife career crisis, or if you're familiar with the story of Martin Luther, you could say I had a fit in the church, you know, where Luther fell out during a Catholic service. And when he came to, he decided he was going to be the driver of Protestantism in Europe. So I actually thought back to that time when I was at Wharton and the things that they taught us about healthcare delivery being flawed and the system and the structure being flawed. Interesting, we're now talking about it a fair bit more. And all the things we needed to do to fix it. I thought they were heretical at first, but by the time I left the program, I was pretty sure they were right. And nothing during my clinical career made me feel any different. I loved medicine. I loved my patients. I missed clinical practice, but decided to transition to the commercial side because I didn't feel like I was working on the project the guys at Wharton asked me to work on. So I moved my family to a different city, took a 75% pay cut initially, and had a succession of roles leading up to where I am now. I was, in a growth stage company for a few years. I then was at a larger company for a few years and then became the chief medical officer for Philips, healthcare, you know, the company that makes the CT scanners and the MRI scanners you push most of your patients into.
I know Philips very well.
Yeah. and then was became CEO of a proteomics company called SomaLogic, took that public and And now I'm chairman of the board of a life sciences company and a venture advisor to a fund called Mubadala out of the UAE.
Okay. All right. We've got to go back a little bit for my non-clinical folks, and particularly for me. Proteomics, what in the world is that?
Well, I think the best way to think about it is to think about genomics. Most people have a pretty good concept of, what genomics is and how it's being used. And then think about applying those same concepts to proteins rather than genes. And the fascinating thing about proteins is that, genes are very important in clinical medicine, but mainly just important for oncology because genetics only really predicts about 5 to 7% of non-oncologic disease. The body, the genome you're born with is a genome you die with. Cancer cells tend to develop their own genetics over time, and that's why they become cancer. But we thought genomics was going to change all of medicine. As it turns out, it's been impactful in some areas, but not really as impactful as we thought. Proteomics, on the other hand, much bigger opportunity because proteins are the products of those genes, and those proteins being made by those genes go up and down depending on your age and whether you're sick or your environmental exposures. And so the signal you get from measuring proteins in the blood is potentially much more informative. So we sold the ability to measure thousands of proteins to biopharma customers and academic customers. And then we, in that company, created diagnostics measuring thousands of proteins at a time instead of only one or two, like you normally do when you go to see the doctor.
Okay. Interesting. Well, I wanted to, for the two of us to talk in our time together, talking about the expansive nature of venture capital in healthcare. Guidehouse said between 2019 and 2023, nearly $47 billion in healthcare-related deal flow took place. One of the key reasons that it said was that healthcare is ripe for innovation, and so you and I both certainly know that. So let's talk a little bit about that. You know, your journey into that venture capital side as an advisor, and all of that. So love to hear your thoughts on that.
Sure. Well, I think that's exactly right about, the opportunity. It's really two things for healthcare. One is that we're well aware, and some of us have been thinking and talking about this for 30 years, and seemingly it's been more front and center in the national consciousness over the last few weeks. We're well aware that American healthcare is ripe for innovation. It's got a number of problems. Despite being the most expensive and largest healthcare delivery system in the world, the outcomes, access, outcomes, administrative functions perform quite poorly. So on one side, there's a huge opportunity for innovation there. However, there's some flawed caveats that go along with that we can talk about. And on the other side, of course, is that healthcare is a growth industry and always will be. There's no shortage of people. The number of people in the world continues to grow, and the ways in which they're affected by illness or cause illnesses within their own bodies are almost limitless. So growth industry, and one that needs innovation, and of course, what I like to think is that the goals of healthcare are the relief of suffering and the prolongation of meaningful life, and there's a lot of opportunity to do those things as well.
Yeah, that's really true. Yeah, and most people think about venture capital in and around like say a biopharma or diagnostics, tech, things like that. But I did see where, fairly recently, a health system was purchased by a venture capital firm. Yeah. And of course, we're seeing just the advent of venture capital going into physician practices, particularly in and around radiology, anesthesiology. Let's talk a little bit about that. What are your thoughts on, I don't have a big problem with the biopharm and more the product side, but I don't want to say problem, but it's an interesting concept of health systems being purchased by VC, and then particularly physician groups, physician practices being purchased by VC. What do you think about that?
Well, traditionally, investment in healthcare and related life sciences has been subdivided into a number of sort of traditional groupings. So digital health, life sciences tools, things like proteomics and genomics, diagnostics, you know, the things that leverage those tools and make clinical inferences from them, and then medical devices. That's been sort of the traditional spate of investment groupings that we've had for a long time. But you're right, more recently, there's been this influx of PE and VC money and health systems. You know, I'm not a huge fan, frankly. The fund that I advise invests primarily in life sciences tools and diagnostics. So it's easy for me to say that without losing my job.
That's good. I don't want you to do that.
But I'm not a big fan. I actually believe that the for-profit orientation of American healthcare is at the root of most of its problems. It's created a fragmented, an incredibly fragmented system that we know artificially drives tons of cost because of that fragmentation. And also, it's created a situation, I think, illustrated by stress episodes like COVID, where it's difficult to respond, you know, to those problems in a coordinated way. And it also has a trickle-down effect on a lot of things, including the things, frankly, that PE and VC firms invest in. So, because the things that generate revenue sometimes line up with the things that populations need, and sometimes line up with the things that relieve suffering and prolong meaningful life, but not always.
Right.
So I'm not a huge fan of the influx of private capital, you know, because VC firms and PE firms have to have a return at some point on the investment. You know, a health system can run uncomfortably, as you're well aware, with very narrow margins, and be okay with that, as long as the bills are getting paid and the clinicians and supporting functions are all being compensated appropriately. So you're not necessarily looking for a 25% return on clinical care.
Sure.
But that's what they're looking for. So, and again, the ways to do that aren't necessarily in line with what populations need.
Yeah, you're exactly right. You know, I've been in the not-for-profit space and the for-profit space, and I took a little venture into some deep post-acute side on the for-profit side, and even those margins were incredibly narrow. We're talking 1-2%, but then, on the more robust post-acute side, the LTAC, the physical rehab. You know, those for-profit companies were looking at, you, as you said, 20-25% rate of return, which made it a little bit more difficult. Yeah. But I will say, you know, I was adamant early in my career that I would not work in for-profit because I got into healthcare for the mission aspect. I like helping people, even though I'm not a clinician. But, you know, somebody presented me with an opportunity to go into for-profit. And I did that and really kind of found out that it's company by company based. I mean, some are great, some aren't so great.
Yeah.
But, we really had to take a really good hard look at that. But I will say on the for-profit side, I learned more about the business aspect early in my career. I learned about efficiencies, and really paying attention to the operational details that, you know, the two systems that I was in before that, great systems, still incredibly well-run systems. But back then, and again, it was 30 years ago, it was so much more mission-based. Yeah. And as you said, the finances were kind of set aside, yeah. And, you know, as long as we were taking care of people. So, you know, again, you know, we touched on a little bit the advent of PE and VC money in the physician group side. You know, there we're seeing in my market just the dire need in some subspecialties, radiology, neurology, anesthesia. And so, you know, with fewer and fewer docs coming out of school and a residency, you know, they're having to do some really, you know, interesting and uncomfortable things, you know, leaning more on AI. And I definitely want to talk about that too. So that requires more capital than many of the physicians and physician groups have. Am I in line there with what you see?
Yeah, I'm not going to disagree with that at all. I think that, you know, providing high quality care can be an incredibly capital intensive endeavor. I also think we chase our tail, though. I mean, if you underinvest in primary care, which we've done for 50 years, then you can guarantee greater demand for, you know, more critical and more advanced care services, and that's expensive care. So it's a self-fulfilling prophecy in my mind. You underinvest in primary care, you provide inadequate access for those things. It's interesting, when you look at the Commonwealth Fund's, you know, report that I've been looking at since 2010 on the performance of the American healthcare delivery system compared to other developed nations in the world, we score high on the process of care. So we're like second out of 10 there, which means that once you get into the system with a bad problem, you got a pretty good shot. I always used to say when I lived in Chicago that if you were a 45-year-old heavily insured executive driving down Lakeshore Drive and had an automobile accident, you know, and had a closed head injury, you'd probably survive. If you were a 65-year-old obese Hispanic woman living in South Chicago and were in a car accident, you might not even find your way to the hospital. So, so process we score not too bad on, but all the other things we score really badly on, access to care, administrative functions, performance, which includes, you know, survival of what should be survivable diseases, we're either last or next to last. And I think that has a lot to do with underinvestment in primary care and heavy investment in these areas that are going to be more capital intense. And that, you know, by nature, we create that market by not allowing people to take very good care of themselves with the help that they need. You know, it always surprised me. When I first started out on the commercial side, I worked for a digital health company that was also sort of a consulting shop. And I remember I went down to a very large physician group in a city in Texas. I'm not going to name the city or the group. And met with them about employing some new digital tools. We were talking about new digital tools to help get people their prescriptions and get them filled on time and so forth. And one of the senior docs said in a meeting that I had, he said, you know, 50% of my damn patients don't even take their prescriptions.
Right.
And I said, well, why don't they? And he said, well, I don't know. It's not my job. And I said, well, whose job is it? You know, expect the general population to suddenly rise up and become experts on how to care for themselves and all be compliant? No, that's not human nature. So again, I think the capital investment is required. And I think part of it's because we create a great market here. And, you know, but it's also a market that can't keep up. And because of that, even though if you're a 45-year-old heavily insured executive, your outcome's going to be pretty good. And if you're not, well, it's sort of catch as catch can.
That's true. You know, years back, there were a lot of very non-traditional healthcare companies that started looking at healthcare, you know, specifically Walmart. mm-hmm. you know, 20, 25 years ago when Walmart started thinking about entering the healthcare space and they tried their clinic models and all of that. Yeah. In hindsight, you're looking back and it made a lot of sense because, you know, you were just talking about the access issue that we all face. And good grief, Walmart is everywhere, every small town, it seems like. And so you would think that would have been a great idea, but it just didn't work. Roy, you know, what's your thoughts? Why didn't it work?
Well, there's been a lot of speculation on this. I have my own thoughts. Back when I was working for Scott & White, I stepped down right before I moved out of healthcare as the department chair and was sort of the system's first chief innovation officer for about 18 months. Okay. And my struggles in that role were one of the reasons I decided that if I was going to make an impact, I probably needed to be working somewhere else. But during that time, we started the country's first commercial entity, nonprofit health system ACO project together with Walgreens.
Okay.
And so I got to speak to the Walgreens people a lot about, you know, their goals at that time around primary care. And it struck me that there were two potential problems. The first is that, let's just be honest, in the current reimbursement system, primary care is a loss leader. Especially if you incorporate, you know, mental health, which should be incorporated because, you know, a large percentage of what drives all illnesses in this country and or compliance with treatment or mental health issues. So the first concern I had was that, you know, you're not going to make money running primary care clinics. You're going to have to subsidize them. And their comeback was that, well, but we're going to drive foot traffic into the pharmacies and the retail areas, and make up for it. You know, and a lot of, as you probably know, retail pharmacies often don't generate a profit either, but they create. And there's a reason why they're in the back of the store. It's because they won't walk past all the shampoo, $20 shampoo, and fingernail clippers on the way there and on the way back. So that was one thing they said. And the second thing that I was surprised by was sort of the lack of clinical expertise being applied to the executive functions of the business. There's always this, it's almost funny now, but it's not funny, where, you know, you get people that aren't trained in healthcare, haven't been exposed to healthcare problems. And when I say not trained, I mean either administratively or clinically not trained in healthcare, who say, I'm going to fix healthcare because I know how to run a business. And they forget that this business is dramatically different from this one. And so to me, it's, you know, primary care has to be, can be a loss leader if you're not driving retail a value for other things, then, you know, your board's going to get upset with you. Don't ask me how I know the boards get upset when you don't make money. And the second thing is that, you know, you need a lot of clinical expertise to set those things up and run them effectively and even these days efficiently. So I think those are two major flaws in the retail model. I'm for the model. I think it could be powerful and it could expand access, but it's obviously been fumbled by everybody that's tried to do it so far.
Boy, you're exactly right. Hey, in the last couple of minutes, it seems like, you know, at least 50% of my episodes over the last 4 or 5 months have been in and around AI. Talk to me a little bit about that. You know, I've had some fascinating conversations, you know, about new AI and diagnostics and treatment and all that. What are you seeing? Just, you know, just kind of a 64,000 foot view and comment of AI and kind of that direction.
Sure. Well, seeing lots of investment in the space. seeing lots of hype in this space, like there has been for other things in the past. Two that come to mind are gene therapy and genomics, where they were going to cure the world's problems, and as it turned out, they turned out to be helpful, but not, you know, panaceas. So lots of hype, lots of new investment. When I worked at Philips, I actually spent most of my time with the AI group, not because I'm a computer scientist, but because I helped them think through, you know, what the most appropriate use cases were, and the impediments to adoption by clinicians and others. I'm a big fan of the use of artificial intelligence in medicine. I'm not worried about it replacing masses of physicians anytime soon. I look at it during our lifetimes as a tool that can do two things. It could potentially make us much more efficient. There's, as you know, there's a ton of non-value added activity like documentation.
Right.
Which does have value, but the payback on the effort that you expend is not what you'd like. And, you know, with natural language processing, we're close to the time where you can just sit in a room and talk and it can be, and you can be charted. And then the second thing is that I actually think that over the last few decades, we've moved through sort of several models of the delivery of healthcare, starting out with what I like to call the era of compassion, which was when humans were first around, you know, several hundred thousand years ago, to the era of trust, where we learned enough about the natural history of disease to tell people what to expect, even though we couldn't cure a lot of things. And now into what I call the era of technology. And we've sort of lost the compassion and trust components of medicine.
Right.
Because we've got to do so much crap and put our fingers into so many things and tap on so many things. I think that AI might actually free up time for clinicians to do more of this. And not even this, to do more of, you know, the thing that we would be doing if I was in the room with you, and that is interacting as humans in the same space. So I you know, I've got some of the same concerns about the long-term impact of AI on civilization, learning, you know, human initiative, not as worried in the short term about Terminator type scenarios, but I've got some of those long-term concerns, but in the short term, you know, over the next few decades, I believe that it's going to make healthcare better.
Yeah, I agree with you. And that's been the conversations that I've had too. And it really has been around that level of efficiency that does allow the clinician to truly interact with their patients in a more personal way. So, Roy, as always, buddy, it's great to see you, and it's great talking to you. You know, you bring such great insights because you've had such a broad and fascinating career. So, Dr. Roy Smythe, thank you so much for joining me on I Don't Care today.
Hey, Kevin, thanks for having me so much. And listen, Merry Christmas and Happy Holidays to you and your listeners.
Thanks, and to you as well. Please tell your family I say hello. Take care.
Take care, buddy. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.